The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And tonight on the show, we have Russ Baker. And how you doing, Russ?
Good, thank you very much.
And you have quite a... quite a bio behind you as far as where you've worked in news, correct?
I've been in news for a while, a quarter century or so, and I've done work for news outlets around the United States, of magazines, newspapers, radio and TV, as well as publications around the world. And I've reported from, four continents or so. So I guess I've done a bit.
And now you have a very impressive website called whowhatwhy.com. And this is your own news organization, basically.
I started it, whowhatwhy, which is .com and .org, denoting that it is a nonprofit. We started it some years ago and have been growing it steadily, albeit a little bit more quietly than we would like. And we are essentially dedicated to using the highest professional journalism standards, but also going after the stories that professional journalism tends not to touch. And we've had a nice reception from folks, and we're very, very open to both story ideas, to experienced journalists joining us, and also, of course, to funding from ordinary people. That's how we support and run the operation. We don't take any ads, and we don't take anything from corporations.
And you're also you try to stay very neutral, very fact-based. You support everything you report with the data.
That's correct. I mean, our basic idea is we want to go into every story without an agenda, although also acknowledging that we don't have amnesia and we do recall what has gone before. And so we'll take everything at face value, and we'll accept that sometimes people and institutions act contrary to character, but we also recognize that there are patterns in how things unfold. And so we try to be wise about that.
Okay. And you don't post 50 articles a day like a lot of news sites. You actually take your time and research the stories thoroughly before posting anything.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that even the biggest news organizations can only turn out a relatively small number of what you might call investigative pieces, where there's initiative, there's original thinking, and a tremendous amount of digging, both in terms of archival work and identifying and interviewing sources. And it just is a lot of work. And so we tend to do that kind of thing. We have a few other things, headlines that we collect and so forth, but we're essentially not an aggregator. We're a source for original information generated by our team.
Okay, and what do you think of the state of the news media in general today?
Well, I mean, the dirty little secret is that it was never really that good, and unfortunately, it's much worse than it was. Shrunk down. There certainly are many more so-called outlets if you consider everything on the internet, but a lot of it is just any person throwing up onto the screen whatever they can find. But in terms of really carefully sourced work, there's less and less of it. Classical investigative journalism is just a pale shadow of what it was before. And as I said, I mean, it was never that good. There never was that much of a commitment by the major news organizations to really dig deep and to really name names of the most powerful people and entities that shape our world. And now it's just very much whatever there was is very much on the decline. So we see a role for whowhatwhy.org very much in creating a new, more vibrant journalism that we hope can turn things around, set an example, and really empower people to live a life of knowledge and effectiveness, and to foster an authentic democracy of some sort, which requires actionable, accurate information.
All right, and also to be clear, you're not like Alex Jones. You're not doing any kind of fear mongering. You're not a conspiracy website, although you will deal with conspiracy subjects if you have the data and the facts behind them.
Yeah, I mean, the term conspiracy is a loaded one, of course, and in fact, really, with the real definition of conspiracy is two or more people colluding to commit a crime, and of course, conspiracies are very much interwoven into humanity and into life and into institutions, and they happen all the time. They're being prosecuted right now, or probably thousands of conspiracy cases throughout the country. So we would define it rather narrowly. We're not interested in a kind of fantastical speculation in an overly neat fashion, identifies every malady in the world with a handful of all-powerful individuals. We don't go for that, certainly.
Okay, all right. And you've written a book, a bestseller, called Family of Secrets, and the hardcover is subtitled The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put the White House and What They Put It in the White House and What Their Influence Means for America. And doesn't the paperback have a different subtitle?
Yeah, the subtitle of Family of Secrets paperback is The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years, which I think better describes what is in it. It situates the Bush family and many generations of that family in the larger schema of interests that have shaped our history in ways that we don't know, ways that I didn't know before I started working on the book, so we thought that was a more accurate subtitle.
And what got you what got you interested in writing this?
I was living abroad for a couple of years after 9/11, training journalists in the former Yugoslavia, the succeeding republics there, on investigative journalism and how it can help create a more transparent society. And while I was there, we began the run-up to the war with Iraq, and it seemed clear to me that this was something that was being driven by imperatives other than the alleged causes of the war. And I wrote about that at the time, and I was becoming increasingly unsettled both about what was happening in my country and also about the failures of journalism to seriously address it. So I returned to the States in 2004 and began covering George W. Bush, who was then running for re-election. I was particularly struck by the fact that we already knew that he had taken the United States to war under false pretenses, and yet here he was either even or ahead in the polls to be reelected. And I found that so fascinating. I thought, clearly the public is not getting a good understanding of what's going on here, and I thought, I'm not sure I fully understand, but I want to dig in and find out. And so throughout 2004, I did research and published a number of articles that opened up some new understanding of various aspects of George Bush and what he represented, and then began thinking that there was a larger story to tell. I didn't know what that story would be fully, because I try to go into my investigations with an open mind and some questions and perhaps a hypothesis, but nothing more. And then I spent the following 5 years trying to understand how somebody as improbable and seemingly unqualified could become essentially the most powerful person in the world. Why did that happen? How did that happen? And I really didn't know the answers, but the years of digging just took me in all sorts of quite astonishing directions, including discovering that there really was another way of looking at how people become president and why they do what they do that I myself had never considered and I hadn't seen being covered either by mainstream historians or by investigative journalists.
Okay, and wasn't also part of it that you had learned that George Bush Sr. didn't know where he was when the Kennedy assassination happened?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember when I learned that. That may have come after 2004. I think that came while I was already working on the book. I began trying to explain George W. Bush and how he got to the top and why he did what he did and what it all meant. What's the real reason he went into Iraq? What's the real reason he did all of these things? And I started finding sources who were telling me these astounding stories from the inside. And the more I dug into him, the more it became clear to me that he simply became president because He came from what was becoming a dynasty that his father had previously been president, and he was able to sort of change up and shake up and freshen up the Bush Family Act and then build on his father's name recognition. But I then started thinking about the father. How had the father become president? And I realized the father also had a sort of a strange trajectory and was an improbable person to even be president of the United States. So as I began digging into him, I thought, let me study his path to the top. And as I did that, I, of course, looked at the fact that he was a president, he was a vice president, he was an opponent of Ronald Reagan, who then became his running mate, which I found fascinating, wanted to know more about that. Then I could see that before he was vice president, he was a CIA director, and he was the only CIA director who ever made it seriously in politics, and that was very interesting to me. And I wanted to know more about his being CIA director. Why had he been named CIA director? He claimed he had no background or experience or essentially qualifications to even be director, and that didn't make any sense to me. So I started digging into that, and what I discovered essentially was that he did have qualifications, that in fact he had been cloaking a background, a secret history of decades of work in the intelligence apparatus. And once I knew that, and I knew that in the throughout the 1970s, the 60s, and even the 50s, he was doing intelligence work under cover of being a oil man or a congressman or what have you, everything that he did or said became interesting to me. And at that point, I happened to read in another book that he, in an interview, had been asked where he was on November 22, 1963, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and what he remembered about that. And that was a benign and harmlessly intended question. And anybody, of course, of a certain age can answer that, but he sort of froze up and could not answer the question. And that seemed interesting to me. It seemed right on my research course. And so I thought, well, let me figure out where he was on November 22, 1963. And that set me onto years of research about the Kennedy assassination, something I really knew very little about, had read very little about, and had never intended to look at. And that really, I must say, changed certainly the book, and I think it changed my life.
And to be clear, you're a nonpartisan site. You're not looking at this as right versus left or anything like that.
Well, I find that stuff pretty useless. And in fact, I find the division of people into clearly defined political camps as one that harms the public interest and benefits essentially special interests who divide and conquer. So, no, we don't go for that at all.
Okay. And this book is around 500 pages, at least the hardcover. And you have, almost 100 pages of footnotes in it?
Yes. I mean, I think it's very important when you're making factual claims to back them up. And so I always try to have a lot of documentation of where things came from. Anybody reading Family of Secrets can go back and check out where these things came from. You know, where did he, where was he on November 22? What are the interviews? Who said what about where he was? What do we know factually? What did he claim that he seems to have forgotten over the years? What does this all have to do with Dallas? What does it have to do with Kennedy and what happened to Kennedy and the allegations about CIA involvement and so forth? So yes, everything is carefully laid out.
All right. And we're recording this about a month before the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. And you've done more work than just look at where Bush was on that date. You've had quite a few articles up on whowhatwhy.com about the Kennedy assassination. Do you think there is any evidence to support the fact that Oswald was a lone gunman?
No. Again, coming in as someone without an axe to grind and no agenda there, I have now reviewed scores of books by all kinds of people who have spent big chunks of their life looking at these things. And I'm talking about retired law enforcement people and lawyers and forensic pathologists and on and on. And overwhelmingly, I can tell you that the consensus of serious people who've looked into this stuff, it is overwhelming that Lee Harvey Oswald first of all, he fired no shots because we have eyewitnesses placing him in a lunchroom on another floor of the building within seconds of the shots purportedly being fired from the sixth floor, and so he could not physically have done that. We also have the fact that you know, they did tests on him, and he had none of the residue that blows up from the rifle onto your face. He had none of that, and those two things alone basically prove that he didn't do it. But there's much, much more to that story. The likelihood, very high, and again documented, that Lee Harvey Oswald was, in his young life, recruited, trained, and put into a whole manner of covert operations and informant roles for various law enforcement and intelligence entities. And so we know that he was involved in things, but all the evidence points to the fact that he was ultimately chosen to be, as he said, a patsy, to be framed for the assassination, with a series of false linkages that he had acted out going back to Cuba and the Soviet Union, because there was a faction that wanted to have Kennedy's death blamed on those two countries, and then use that as a justification to launch a war against them, that these interests in the military and the intelligence community and in the private world had long been chafing to achieve.
If you had to put your money on someone being behind it, who would you say was behind the assassination?
Well, I'm still studying it. I'm taking a long view of it, and I think there are more books to come. But I would say that these sorts of things don't necessarily evolve in a straight line. And as I document in Family of Secrets, even though, again, it's about the Bush dynasty, I have five chapters of new information on the Kennedy assassination. And one of those chapters is about all of these interests that were opposed, and I mean violently opposed, to John F. and Robert F. Kennedy and what they were doing. And these interests were so diverse that you have to accept that there was a kind of a growing consensus by various power centers that these two men represented a threat to them, and a mortal threat, and that they had to be removed. And once you see that, whether it was organized crime that was being prosecuted or Cuban exiles that felt that the Kennedys were selling out their cause, that they were running out of time to remove Castro, or it was Lyndon Johnson, who was being implicated in a number of corruption investigations and faced the possibility, A, of being removed from the re-election ticket in 1964, and B, ending up spending his years in jail himself, or J. Edgar Hoover, who had intimidated all the prior presidents and stayed in for an incredibly long run at the FBI, who understood that his days were numbered if the Kennedys stayed. To go on and on, the steel industry, the oil industry, so many of these interests were basically infuriated, enraged with the Kennedys and with what they were doing, and all of them stood to gain if they were removed. So the actual mechanics of it is something else, but I think that if we are broad-minded, and when we look at events, we understand that very often you see some sort of a consensus arrived at. Doesn't mean that all of the parties that agree about something talk to each other or need to be in on so-called the plot itself. They have to just be supportive of the result and willing to not push for an investigation afterwards. In other words, a lot of them were wittingly or unwittingly participants in the subsequent cover-up, which, by the way, has continued to the present day, including, I would say, the news media, which basically is largely owned and run by very wealthy, very successful pillars of the community, and which are always pushing the line of cohesion and bringing the country together and discouraging any kind of destabilizing developments. Media in this country, very quick to want to wrap up any serious inquiries into what you might call deep politics of this country, and not eager to get to the bottom of things, if getting to the bottom of it might cause some kind of serious destabilization or lack of public trust in the basic institutions of our society.
What do you make of the deathbed confessions there of Howard Hunt?
I'm agnostic on those things, because you have to look at them and see what the evidence is that they actually said what they did, and what exactly did they say, and what does it mean, who says they said it. So I'm not taking a stand on that particular thing right now. The way I like to work, the very nature of whowhatwhy.com and the very nature of Family of Secrets, is that it's a vast tapestry where I've woven in hundreds or thousands of indisputable, documented facts, in letting the public, letting the reader come to their own conclusions. I think you're never going to be able to tie these things up that neatly. So actually, there are a lot of people who have come forward to say that they were gunmen or they were part of the cover-up or this or that. There are a lot of those people. I think we want to look at what they have to say, but I don't know that taking anyone's word is ever going to, in itself, bring us to some kind of resolution.
Okay. Do you think it's more likely there was a small group that actually knew all the details, and there may have been other people who were aware but maybe didn't have the details or had at least a plausible deniability behind it?
Yeah. I mean, I think the way that America runs is that there is some kind of a consensus, and that people who have a lot of power, whether they're big bankers or they are considered to be sort of statesmen who come in and out of government and go into the private sphere, or they're powerful people within the military or longstanding intelligence titans like Alan Dulles. I think these people all know each other. They socialize, they golf together, and they know each other, and they talk about these things. And I think that's where something like that is arrived at, and then everything becomes tremendously compartmentalized. You have plausible deniability, and even the people who perhaps made a decision to move forward with something made sure that they were protected in certain ways, that they didn't know details, and that even if they were made to tell what they knew, it would be very, very little. So, I mean, that's the nature. If you talk to people who work in these intelligence agencies, they are so compartmentalized that many of the people who do things are given false stories as to why they do them. They're the person who's telling them to do something, they don't even know their real name and so forth. And so you up and down the line, you have something like that. A person like Alan Dulles, who I do think was complicit and witting in this. In fact, you can see it by his own suspicious behavior both before and after the assassination. It seems that any fair-minded person looking would say that he definitely was part of the, let's say, board of directors of this plot.
Do you think we're ever going to see any real investigation into this by, like, the government or any powers that be?
No, I don't think you're ever going to see it by the government, and I don't think you're ever going to see it by the major news organizations. It's too big a story. I remember at one point in my career, one of my editors, when I was sort of just starting out, he said, go out and get me a big, big story. So I want something that's really going to, you know, make people's eyeballs pop. And so I went out and I worked like the Dickens, and I came back with something, and he read it silently, and he read it, and he read it, and he read it, and he looked at me and he said, that's too big. And, of course, I'll never forget that, because that was the message. They want something good and they want something juicy, but if you're telling the public, hey, we discovered that the emperor has no clothes, and, you know, you're writing for, you know, the Emperor Weekly, I mean, it's a no-go.
Huh. One of the articles you wrote on JFK had something to do with the Umbrella Man, I think it was called.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of just a zillion odd things. At the very moment that Kennedy's limousine was passing the spot where at which he would be shot, a man standing there began pumping an umbrella. This was on a bright sunny day, and he was accompanied by another man who had what appeared to be a walkie-talkie. I would say that any detective, anybody looking into that in any other circumstances, would want to know more about that. This has not been looked into seriously. In fact, when the House Select Committee on Assassinations convened, they were actually contacted by a man who offered himself as Umbrella Man, and he came in and gave this sort of silly story about that he was just doing something innocuous to send a message to Kennedy, and this was then picked up by the New York Times with another absurd twist on it. This is not only dishonest; it's a kind of a test of how foolish the public is, whether they would buy these kinds of sort of feeble explanations of highly suspicious behavior.
And why do you think people will buy this type of stuff? Is it just that they're used to taking authorities' word on it, or
You know, I think we all suffer from cognitive dissonance complex. It's hard to get through life. It's hard to get through the day and the week and deal with the basic things of survival and family and so forth that we have to deal with. And if we also have to deal with the possibility that the big picture is much, much worse, the big picture of a society to which we all belong and participate and, I guess, benefit from, we don't want to hear that. That's just too much. That's just too hurtful. And so when we hear these things, we consign them all to nuttiness. We just say, well, that's nuts. And I'm no different. I mean, as a journalist, and I think most journalists, you got your nose to the grindstone and you go for the low-hanging fruit. You do your stories, which are pretty good, but you don't really go after the most powerful people and institutions, and you don't really dig that deep into what really ails us. And so when you hear these kinds of things, you just say, oh, that's insane, which, because it sounds insane. And, of course, it sounds insane if you're spending your life in a cave. When somebody describes what's outside the cave, it sounds insane.
Do you think the Kennedy assassination was kind of like the turning point in this country?
I do. And one of the people I've interviewed in recent years who played something of a bit part in that whole saga, who I think hasn't been entirely candid with me because he's afraid and ashamed, nevertheless, has said to me on several occasions that he repeats the phrase that the great American experiment ended with Kennedy's death. And he doesn't mean that in some sort of abstract or lofty way. He literally means that there was an experiment going on and it was over at that moment. That was the end of it. And I agree. I think no American president since John F. Kennedy has really dared to greatness, has dared to try to actually be president. Really be that powerful person and have a vision and adhere to the vision that fills the rhetoric. And I just think that they understand that that's not possible. By the way, in Family of Secrets, I don't know if you're going to be getting to this, but I then began looking at where George H.W. Bush was when Nixon was removed. And there he was again, very close to the events. And I discover many of the same people from the Bay of Pigs, people from Dallas, November 22, 1963, again involved in the events that resulted in the removal of yet another president, this one Richard Nixon, under a very different set of circumstances, and no blood was shed, but the effect was somewhat the same. And I was stunned to find that Richard Nixon himself, as different as he was from John F. Kennedy, was also attempting fate by pushing a number of buttons that were not to be pushed. And so we see that when we look at a guy like Obama, we can't possibly understand why he does what he does and doesn't do more and doesn't take bigger risks unless we understand what has come before.
Yeah. Well, that was something I was going to mention. I mean, how much power do you think someone like Obama has nowadays?
I think he has some power, but I think it's very, very limited. So, for example, they're able to, go after Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, and extract what appears to be a huge fine of $13 billion. It is a huge fine. But, in fact, when you look at it, that's a fine that really doesn't rattle. That's such a big outfit. It doesn't really rattle them substantially. It's a hit. But they're very much going to survive. Everybody's going to get their salaries, and the shareholders are going to do okay. And, you know, that's just the cost of doing business. And so when you understand that, you see that, yes, Barack Obama probably goes after the banks much harder than Mitt Romney would. But in the end, the banks do just fine, and nothing really changes.
And it seems that's especially true of things like foreign policy.
But it's very true of foreign policy. Foreign policy, if you look at Obama, I mean, he's given more power to the military, more power to the intelligence agencies. He's been as emphatic in support. I don't know if you say emphatic because he says he doesn't want to do these things, but in the end, he's prosecuting wars all over the world that are just as Bush falsified the reasons for Iraq, as we document on whowhatwhy.com. They falsified the reasons for going into Libya, and they are now falsifying the reasons for going into Syria. This is a machine. It's an apparatus apparatus of empire, and it does what it does, and no person is going to stop it. So almost indistinguishable on most of the foreign policy, almost indistinguishable on the big picture of the financial interests that dominate this country. So on those things, very, very different. On certain things, there's no question on things like health care that he is making an effort to try to do what he and I guess certainly his base perceive as a little bit of leveling the playing field for those who don't have the kind of power and resources necessarily to take care of themselves or get a fair shake. And there is a difference. There is a substantive difference. The same thing on some of the social issues, things like the abortion issue and all those hot button issues of gay marriage and so forth. You'll see a difference. A lot of that is playing to the base for political purposes. And again, the base are perfectly happy to be thrown those various somewhat meaty bones and are willing then to sort of overlook the thrust of the things you raised with the foreign policy issue.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Russ Baker.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we are talking tonight with Russ Baker, author of Family of Secrets, and his website is whowhatwhy.com, which is an independent news site in the truest sense of the word, nonpartisan, and not paid for by anyone but the readers, correct?
That's right. We depend on people like those listening tonight to allow us to do open-ended, open-minded, non-agenda-driven inquiries into how our world works and how it affects all of us.
And your articles are very thorough. They're not little tidbits and stuff. You write substantial amounts of information, all backed by links to where the information came from, which is not something you see in most news organizations.
That's true, you do see news organizations more and more linking, but they're often just linking to other things that they wrote. We do link to other things we wrote that provide background, but we very much try to link to reports and other documentation that will undergird the factual points.
Do you think there is, what hope does this country have of getting out of the sort of downward spiral it's in at this point?
Despite these I guess potentially pessimistic tone of the things that I'm saying, I am an optimist because I believe that things can change for the good, of course for the bad too, almost at any moment and with almost any causation. We've seen this throughout history. People always say to me, well, I'm one person and what can I do? But actually, almost everything meaningful in the world, whether it's inventions or causes, were launched by one person. And one person in almost every case has changed our thinking. That's why we know that the Earth is round. That's why we understand gravity. That's why we have modern food processing practices, is because of one person. And so they were not necessarily somebody who was well-connected or had resources. It was just a very determined person. So we believe that there's always a possibility of tremendous positive change. We're hoping that whowhatwhy.com it can be one of those kernels. But I would say that anybody out there, anybody listening to this, can make a difference, even in just small ways that don't have to be putting you on the firing line. One of the examples I give is if you just simply forward things that you read that you found persuasive to other people, you are multiplying your own influence, and you don't know, but maybe somebody you send it to or somebody that they send it to may be the person who then says, hey, I'm going to do something about this, or maybe they say, I'm going to write a check to Who, What, Why, so they can hire 20 more reporters and go after some more stories. I mean, there's lots of different ways that our moving from passivity to activity can change the world.
Okay. I completely forgot what I was just going to ask. Let's move on a little bit to Michael Hastings. And now he was... Of course, the conspiracy theories around him are all over the place at this point. But he was investigating some hotbed issues and then died in a mysterious way. Have you investigated much of this?
We have, in fact, on many of these issues. I would call it the deep politics issues, whether it's the death of Michael Hastings, prosecution and potential jail sentence of 100 years facing Barrett Brown, a journalist in this country, or the mysteries and inconsistencies of the official account of the Boston Marathon bombing. WhoWhatWhy.com has been not only a leader, but pretty much alone in looking into these things in a serious journalistic way, as opposed to what you were talking about, the fear-mongering and the wild speculation. So in the case of Michael Hastings, Michael Hastings was a journalist working for Rolling Stone and other entities. He had done a very famous article about General Stanley McChrystal, the leader of the U.S. forces in Afghanistan. That article, which many may remember, caused a tremendous hullabaloo, resulted in General McChrystal being fired by President Obama, and that was Michael Hastings' article. He went on to do a number of other interesting articles and was, at the time of his death working on stories about the CIA, the NSA, about major outsourced corporations involved with the national security state. He was digging into a lot of dark alleys. And the circumstances of his death are strange. And if you go to whowhatwhy.com, you can watch video of the fiery crash of his car in a one-car accident where he's driving on a straight street in Los Angeles, and his car just basically turns into a fireball. Some eyewitnesses claiming that the car actually exploded just before it hit a tree. Even if it didn't, there are some questions as to how a fireball of that nature is a result of a car hitting a tree. The impact, the flinging the Mercedes engine as far as it did. And there are some real questions. Also, the fact that he had sent an email the day before he was killed saying that he was going off the radar because he was working on some very sensitive stuff, and also mentioning that he was aware that he claimed that the FBI was investigating him. And so all of these things just point to the fact that journalists need to be responsible and look into that. And the failure of the media in this country, and I include not just the mainstream sort of corporate media, but your favorite, you know, kind of alternative, you know, liberal or conservative news organization, why have none of them done their due diligence on this? This, I think, is really in itself a condemnation of the state of journalism.
And what's your opinion on things like WikiLeaks? You have at least linked to some of their stuff in the past, right?
Yes, we have cooperated and partnered with WikiLeaks when it comes to assessing documents that they post and trying to provide the public with a service, which is to assess the accuracy, significance, and larger context of those documents. And so we feel that we are not the ones who obtained those documents. We're not the ones who posted them per se. But we think that it is an invaluable role for journalism to try to help people understand when these kinds of things emerge, what to make of them.
Okay. Do you think that what they're doing is a service to people by releasing these documents, or do you think that they're causing more problems than good for the most part?
In general, I would say that transparency is a good thing in a democracy. And we live in a country where there is less and less transparency. There is more and more terror in the form of our being told that we have reasons to be afraid. We're afraid of these unknown people who want to harm us, or whether we're supposed to be afraid of the government watching our every move. We do live in a kind of a state of terror, and we need accurate information to assess, are we really at risk, or are we just being made to feel fearful and thereby empower those who make us feel fearful and give them more power over us? All of these things are important questions. What is national security? They use that term an awful lot. What does that mean? How does that so-called national security translate into our personal security? What is this vast homeland security apparatus that has been built up? Tremendous amounts of our own tax dollars going into the pockets of private individuals and corporations that supposedly are doing all this work for us. We need to know a lot more. And so I would say we ought to err on the side of openness and let those who would deny us vital information prove to us why it is that we can't be told these things.
And going back to Kennedy for a moment, there's a bunch of papers that were supposed to have been released and have now been pushed back, what, another 30 years?
The 2017, there are a number of different dates, and it gets complicated, but 2017 is a date at which we are supposed to see some of the remaining documents. But in fact, on whowhatwhy.com, we have been covering this issue of the records and how Obama himself has been very complicit in the withholding of documents that the public ought to be able to see. They keep coming up with other reasons for that, but very simple. I mean, logic is what you want to use here. If, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman or a lone nut, acted alone, and there was nothing more to the Kennedy assassination, why has the government held on to so many assassination-related documents for so many years? Why do they continue to do that? And we think this is a very vital issue because we think that those documents that they're withholding help shed light on what has actually happened to America and what is the texture and the state of democracy since the Kennedy assassination up to the present time.
What do you think would have been different had they failed in this assassination of Kennedy?
Well, if they had failed, among other things, the response from those, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and their small circle of trusted confidants would have certainly, I think, been even more aggressive than what they were already doing. A lot more heads would have rolled. You know, obviously, if it had been investigated and this was laid at the doorstep of some of America's wealthiest and most powerful individuals, families, and interests, you know, you're looking at an anything-goes situation. It's interesting how in the United States we have all this, you know, Arab Spring, and we're all for all these revolutions. We support revolution in Syria. Isn't it great that the people rise up and overthrow the yoke, you know? But, I mean, we have a yoke in our own country, and we always do. And anybody who suffers from the mistreatment and deception that is inherent in so much of our daily life at the hands of large, powerful corporations knows that. And so, you know, if we support freedom and transparency and true democracy everywhere else, it wouldn't be such a bad thing to try it here. And I think that had the assassination failed, we might have seen a very vigorous experiment with a better democracy. And I think that was yet another reason that it was so, so important that that the assassination succeed. I think that's why we see evidence that they couldn't have used one gunman, that they had to triangulate and use a number of them, possibly, and I don't know, I'm no expert, people shooting from distances and even people shooting from close up. And then you had to have a very, very effective cover-up, which has continued to the present day in the form of people understanding that their careers, whether it's in the media or in publishing or in academia, is dependent on them mouthing these platitudes saying, well, we don't know what really happened, or we believe that Oswald did it, when in fact the evidence is very, very different. The system itself needed to sort of come together and shut down that line of inquiry.
Do you think that part of the concern is that these documents will implicate people who are still alive and that the later they release them, the chances are these people will all be dead and can't be held accountable?
Yeah, I mean, the witnesses to any piece of this, and there are plenty of them, are dying off rapidly. And those of us who are investigating to see this, I wish I had the resources and the people and the time to get to more of them. But, you know, it's a race because you got the other guys also trying to get to those people to tell them to keep their mouths shut. And, yeah, I mean, I think it's a time situation because 10 or 20 years from now, they'll say, well, who cares because they're all dead anyway. There's always a story, you know, we can't do it now because it's too unsettling. Later it's we can't do it because who cares. So absolutely, totally agree.
Why wouldn't they just try and destroy those documents in the first place so they can never come out?
That's a good point. I'm sure that the most important documents have been destroyed. Or let me put it this way, the most important documents never existed. The second most important documents that they were able to find have been destroyed. But the reality is that government is a complex beast with a lot of different pieces to it. There are pieces of paper floating around everywhere, and it's not that easy to find, identify, and destroy documents. And there are good people everywhere working in the archives and so on, and they're not all complicit in this. And so it's just, you know, if somebody were to go and try to destroy all these things, they would leave a trail of evidence. And so that then would become de facto evidence of the conspiracy itself. And so there, this is a game. And over the years, researchers have done a very good job of knitting together just little tiny pieces. I don't think there is a smoking gun document out there announcing a formal operation. I don't think there ever is, but there certainly are lots of little pieces that are helpful.
Okay. Now, when the Boston bombing happened, of course, Alex Jones was out there in 5 minutes saying it was a false flag, and as were other people. You didn't do that. You waited and you assessed the information, and then you your articles basically ask questions. You show the data, you show the facts, and you point where they're inconsistent or don't work, but you don't go into any kind of wild speculation or any kind of fear-mongering, anything like that. And I absolutely love that about your site. Do you want to go over a few of the inconsistencies you did discover on the Boston bombing?
Well, sure. I mean, the first thing is right from the get-go, the way in which the information came out, the assertions made by the media about the guilt of these brothers, it chilled me, because having spent years looking at the Kennedy assassination, I said, my God, this is exactly what they did to Lee Harvey Oswald. It was a so-called rush to judgment, a rush to conclude we know who did it. I mean, with Oswald, they literally, FBI was leaking within days that they'd already solved the whole case and there was nothing more to do. And here's the FBI with the Boston bombing, again doing exactly the same thing. We have yet to see any actual evidence that those two brothers did anything, yet one is dead. The other one was basically essentially left for dead. They certainly tried to kill him. A third guy, and we'll have some upcoming more stories on that, although we've done some already, in Florida, who was a friend of theirs, was shot and killed by an FBI officer, supposedly when he attacked him, if you believe that. And so the witnesses are just drying up. And you know, this story, more than anything else, makes you say, boy, what really is going on in this country? What really are these institutions like the FBI and the CIA? And can we trust what we're told? And then you see the failures in the media. So in terms of the inconsistencies, I mean, they're everywhere. The FBI originally, you may remember, said, we don't, you know, does anybody, here's some video of some suspicious-looking guys with backpacks. Does anybody know who they are? And then it took the Russians to say, excuse me, hello, we know who they are. And you know who they are because we pointed them out to you some years ago and said we were worried that these guys were terrorists. So we find out, the FBI is like, oops, oh, yeah, sorry, one hand didn't know what the other hand was doing. Yes, we did know who they were, but we sort of checked them out, and there wasn't anything there. And, you know, all of that suggests that they're lying. And the FBI has a long history, as with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, of being deeply involved with recruiting people who then infiltrate terrorist cells. And our question in one article on our site by Peter Dale Scott is there a possibility that, as in many of these other cases, that Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older brother, was himself, had been recruited either voluntarily or otherwise into some sort of a terror cell? And where that goes is complex and requires much more research, but that's a reasonable question that a journalist ought to be asking.
And, of course, the media, the mainstream media in this country, just kind of went along with what they were told without questioning any of it, even slightly.
Well, that's right. And so the funny thing about being a journalist in these big institutions is all you have to do is do mea culpas. Oh, we screwed up. And they have these panels all the time with the ones who screwed up, given a platform to talk about how they screwed up, and then the platform gives them more public attention, more credibility, and more power, and then they can go back and screw up again. And then those who didn't screw up, those who asked the right questions, are denied a platform. And we see this time and again. My own experience of many years of doing work for well-respected journalistic brands, but always being a little bit of an outsider. And with my book, Family of Secrets, you know, that I was originally told that people at all these major television and radio shows, newspapers and so on, thought the book looked outstanding, were very interested, and they wanted to have me on the shows. Then one after another, they all canceled me. And I think decisions are made at high levels that this stuff is too hot, people, they cannot take the risk of being the ones of promoting it. And so it was left to a network of the kind of people who listen to your show to buy copies of Family of Secrets. It's still just being discovered. It is a bestseller. It's sold almost 100,000 copies. But it's all by word of mouth. It's all by this kind of public uprising using the internet and communicating with each other, and then selected, say, radio shows like yours that are willing to give people information they can't get anywhere else. And so there's this constant battle for the truth that's going on today with, as you say, the Boston bombing, the Hastings one-car crash, and these other stories that simply the media consider too hot to handle.
And you are not, unless I'm mistaken, you are not a believer in the inside job theory for 9/11.
You know, look, I'm agnostic. It's very, very simple, and I'm not even talking about 9/11. I am agnostic about almost everything, because if you look through history, if you went with the mainstream, you believed the Earth was flat. If somebody told you they were going to invent a device where they could talk to somebody who was in another city, you would say, well, you're insane. So, look, anything is possible. That's my attitude. Is it possible that there's more to that story? Absolutely. And who, what, why, although we, again, are very, very careful, and we will not. There are a lot of angry, you know, 9/11 truthers who think that we're cop-outs. But the fact is that, you know, we need to dig up original information. We're not just going to traffic in things that other people say. We're going to take a good, hard look at it to see what we can and cannot prove or check out. And but we have on Who, What, Why done a number of stories, original reporting about some strange and disturbing connections between some of the people we were told were the hijackers and the Saudi royal family. And this is a different story than what Michael Moore had in his movie. It's very, very curious and very disturbing. And that has been our contribution. So we are open to the idea that the official story on anything is not the whole story.
Well, I just think that personally, I think every story should be questioned from every angle. I think that news organizations should take that agnostic stance that you have, that, I mean, truth is such a fleeting thing and is so hard to fully prove, but asking questions is the only way we're really going to get down to any kind of resemblance of truth about anything.
Well, I heartily concur with you, and that's our attitude. Our attitude is, if people say, well, what's your goal? My answer is, we just want to know what happened.
Yeah. All right, so the book, once again, Family of Secrets, the hardcover is The Bush Dynasty, the Powerful Forces That Were Put in the White House and What Their Influence Means for America. And has the book changed from the hardcover to the softcover, or just the subtitle?
The soft cover has a new foreword and a new afterword, I believe, and it's got some more endorsements from some interesting figures like Gore Vidal now on the cover. It's essentially the same material. We corrected a few very small errors, but basically they're both Family of Secrets, and I think either one would do just fine.
Okay, and whowhatwhy.com is the website, and whowhatwhy.org. Do they go to the same place?
They do go to the same place, yes.
Okay, and you basically survive on donations. Has when you look out there at all these different news organizations, do you think the ones overseas do a better job? Like if people tune into the BBC, are they pretty much paid off by the same powers that be, or do you think that they do a slightly better job?
Yeah, that's a complex situation. I mean, I think that there are some better news organizations in some respects, BBC in some ways, certainly The Guardian in London, the newspaper in some ways, Al Jazeera in some ways, but in other ways, they're no good at all. And so it's the same thing domestically. There's certain subjects that certain magazines and newspapers will do a very fine job of in the United States. I think the problems with journalism are global. And that's why we have great ambitions for, with the support of people like those who are listening to this program, that we'll be able to build Who, What, Why into a formidable global journalistic institution for the future.
And I certainly hope that happens. I like the fact that your articles are so in-depth, that you do the depth of research that you do. It's a nice change from what you normally get out there on the internet. And you do a lot of speaking as well, a lot of interviews, and you post a lot of those to your site as well, correct?
Yeah, I mean, we need to introduce ourselves and our work to new audiences, and so I do travel a fair amount and do public speaking, radio, some television, and we're always happy if folks are members of organizations and they want to invite me or other people from Huawei to come and speak. We'll be glad to try and make that happen.
All right. Well, I thank you so much for making time for us. And again, whowhatwhy.com. And we've been talking to Russ Baker. Anything else people should know?
No, I mean, they can follow us on Twitter at whowhatwhy. We've got a whowhatwhy Facebook page, and Family of Secrets is available in bookstores and also on from the usual suspects online.
All right. Well, I thank you, Russ. Last Exit for the Lost is up next. Some Psyche Corporation to take you out.
Come in. Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5-8-3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. And counting. Can you hear?